Welcome to Reading Together, a Near FM initiative co-funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland's Sound and Vision Fund. The Near FM crew travelled to public locations around the city where different readers from local communities read the 15 stories that constitute James Joyce's book, The Dubliners. Dubliners was designated by Dublin, One City, One Book, as 2011 Book of the Year. Near FM wants to join in the celebration, organising a series of public readings where Joyce's Dubliners would be read in public places to reach a wider audience. On the 8th of March this year, we visited the Access Arts and Community Resource Centre in Ballymun to celebrate International Women's Day with the reading of two of the Dubliner stories that focus on women's life, A Mother and The Boarding House. But first, let's talk to Deirdre Quinn, Media and English Lecturer in NUI Maynooth, who will tell us about Joyce's writing and his representation of women.
I'm Deirdre Quinn. I teach at the National University of Ireland, Maynooth, in Media and English. My interest, although I teach in literature and media, my interest is really personal, and it's more about my love of reading James Joyce and just experiencing what is presented in Dubliners and what is presented in Ulysses each time that I dip back into them, you know, and just being able to connect with the themes and think about how they're relevant today and how universal they are, how we all have experienced some of the pain and the happiness and the hurt that you find throughout James Joyce. So that's where my personal interest comes from. I've attempted Finnegan's Wake, but I'm afraid I've never really managed anything past about page 10. But the others, I found Ulysses very difficult at first. So I first encountered it when I was about 19, 20, and I didn't really get it. You know, I enjoyed it, but I knew that I was missing a lot. And as I kept dipping back into it, and I didn't read from page one to the end. I would just dip into different episodes. And as I did that, I started to gather a greater understanding of what was going on. And also when I went to join reading groups, that helped a lot. I was able to ask other people questions about references that I didn't get or I didn't understand. And because other people were reading out loud, I was able to experience the funny bits and the bawdy bits of Ulysses that I didn't quite cotton on to when I read it by myself. So the group readings helped a lot. I've been to the group reading that I know you're familiar with in Sweeney's. That was probably the most influential one, because I think there's a huge range of people that come into that group. People who just are tourists and are walking by and happen to join for the evening. There are other people which, much to my delight, had a knowledge of Latin and were able to read the Latin bits and explain what they meant to somebody like me who wouldn't have a background in Latin. And there were, you know, people from Dublin with, you know, those great Dublin accents. So they were able to bring, you know, their richness to the reading of the text as well. So that was the most influential one. After that, also we've set up one but just with my friends, and we read to each other and, you know, just discuss it, the episode afterwards, and usually have a glass of wine along with it. I think both. I think the individual will always be able to engage with it. But when you engage with it in a group level as well, you're able to draw new meanings from it that you may not have had by yourself, because the voices differ and, you know, it becomes a more layered experience. So I think both of them. I really enjoy the group readings, and just that brings a social aspect to it as well that usually people might think isn't present in Joyce, you know, that it's just for people sitting in libraries on their own. But really, when it's read in that group atmosphere, it brings a new aspect, a new factor to the experience, you know, and you can have a bit of crack together while you read it. I'm not going to say that it's not challenging. It is. Joyce's writings are challenging, but the earlier writings are more accessible to readers than the later writings. Finnegan's Wake is cryptic. It's much more difficult than even Ulysses. But I think both are readable. But for somebody who may be anxious about starting or throwing themselves into those huge challenges, Dubliners and A Portrait of the Artist would be really good places to start. And you even see in A Portrait of the Artist, he begins with childlike language and ends with more complex language. So he's bringing the reader along on an experience as well as the style develops. So as the story gains momentum and the plot gains momentum, the reader will be able to garner more from the reading as well. And Dubliners is probably the most accessible for a new reader to Joyce, because it's, you know, divided, as you know, into the 15 stories. And in ways they overlap and relate to each other, even though they're standalone. So the readers will be able to see and find things in them that are carried on. You can see how his style in Finnegan's Wake, and, you know, draws from how he as a writer has developed throughout his life. It is published much later, I think it's 1941. So he's done a lot of work stylistically, but also Finnegan's Wake is breaking through language barriers and preconceptions we have of how language works and what it is. And I suppose the reward in Finnegan's Wake is that when you can read it and decipher it, you're also understanding how language works for you on a daily basis. So by breaking down the boundaries, you understand more about how you work with language each day. So it is, anything I've attempted with it has been very rewarding, but it is much more challenging. The themes are universal, and just the idea of being human as well, it's very important to each novel. So therefore, I think it continues to be relevant, but even in particular in relation to Ireland, you can see how, for example, in Evelina, Evelina herself, she's afraid to make a decision, and she's very much being influenced by loyalties she feels she should have, you know, to her family, to her father, who's treating her very badly, and yet she lives up to those loyalties, and as a result, she finds it very difficult to break free and make an individual life for herself. So I think those kind of social pressures and familial pressures, people will still be very familiar with those today in Ireland, especially given the kind of conditions we're living through at the moment. And the others, I know you read The Boarding House. Yeah, just again, pressures people feel to improve their situations, and pressures perhaps family members can put on others to improve their situations, and you know, despite the consequences, you know, those themes are still relevant today. So, you know, while it's set much earlier in the last century, you know, the complications of society haven't really changed that much for us. I think his portrayal of women it varies, like his portrayal of men. You know, there are what are perceived as very weak characters and perhaps corrupt characters present. And then there are also very, very strong characters who persevere and who can endure a lot. And so his portrayal of women is complex and varied, and he's also fair. You know, people may perceive some of the treatments as unfair, but really when you consider his whole body of work, you see that you get those types of women that you see in The Boarding House, the mother who really wants her daughter to marry well. And you'll get other types of women like Evelina, who, you know, can't, who's procrastinating and may seem weak, but is also very willing to sacrifice the idea, her freedom, for family loyalties, and that shows strength as well as weakness. So one of the great things about Joyce is that he shows us the complexities of being human of, you know, all the pull and the push factors that influence us on a daily basis. And his portrayal or his writing of Penelope in, you know, the last episode of Ulysses, it's really interesting to see how a male writer writes in that very strong female voice, especially when, you know, some people may become uncomfortable with it when they realize that this is a male writing a very strong female voice that's erotic at times. So people might find that both interesting and strange at the same time. So his female characters are I think they're a fair reflection of how people still exist in their daily lives, both male and female, that they're constantly being influenced by different factors in the world. I think, you know, the type of characters that you meet around Dublin are, you know, very similar to the type of characters, you know, they're full of banter, they're full of charm, and, you know, you'll have strong accents and more refined accents, and you'll have people like Father Conmee in Ulysses, who's very much navigating his way around the city in a strategic way. He may not be a father, a priest anymore, but he'll have similar types of moral characters. And you'll also have the type of tricksters. And there are other things, I think, to be learned as well, you know, and things like A Painful Case. You may have people who are paralyzed by fear and social pressures and moral pressures out of pursuing their own individual ambitions or goals. And, you know, we still have those kinds of people around Dublin as well today. So there's still a lot that we can take, and there are a lot of similarities between Dubliners today and Joyce's Dubliners.
And next is The Boarding House.
The Boarding House. Mrs. Money was a butcher's daughter. She was a woman who was quite able to keep things to herself, a determined woman. She had married her father's foreman and opened the butcher's shop near Spring Gardens. But as soon as his father-in-law was dead, Mr. Money began to go to the devil. He drank, plundered the till, ran headlong into debt. It was no use making him take the pledge. He was sure to break out again a few days after. By fighting his wife in the presence of customers and by buying bad meat, he ruined his business. One night he went for his wife with the clever, and she had to sleep in the neighbor's house. After that, they lived apart. She went to the priest and got separation from him with care of the children. She would give him neither money nor food nor house room, and so he was obliged to enlist himself as a sheriff's man. He was a shabby, stooped little drunkard with a white face and white moustache and white eyebrows penciled about his little eyes, which were pink, veined and raw. And all day long he sat in the bailiff's room waiting to be put on a job. Mrs. Money, who had taken what remained of her money of the butcher's business, set up a boarding house in Hendrick Street. She was a big, imposing woman. Her house had floating population made up of tourists from Liverpool and the Isle of Man, and occasionally artists from the music halls. Its resident population was made up of clerks from the city. She governed her house cunningly and firmly. She knew when to give credit, when to be stern, when to let things pass. All the resident young men spoke to her as the Madame. Mrs. Money's young men paid 15 shillings a week for board and lodgings, beer or stout at dinner excluded. They shared in common tastes and occupations, and for the reason they were very charming with one another. They discussed with one another the chances of favors and outsiders. Jack Money, the Madame's son, who was a clerk to a commission agent in Fleet Street, had a reputation of being a hard case. He was fond of using soldiers' obscenities. Usually he came home in a small hours. When he met his friends, he had always good one to tell them, and he was always sure to be on a good thing, what is to say, a likely horse or a likely artist. He was also handy with the meats and sung comic songs. On Sunday nights, where would often be a reunion in Mrs. Money's front drawing room, the music hall artists would oblige. The Sheridan played valses and polkas and vamp accompaniments. Polly Money, the Madame's daughter, would also sing. She sang, "I am a naughty girl. You needed shame. You know I am." Polly was a slim girl of 19. She had light, soft hair and a small, full mouth. Her eyes, which were grey with shade of green through them, had a habit of glancing upwards when she spoke with anyone, which made her look like a little perverse Madonna. Mrs. Money had first sent her daughter to be a typist in the corn factor's office, but as a disreputable sheriff's man used to come every other day to the office, asking to be allowed to say a word to his daughter, she had taken her daughter home again and set her to do housework. As Polly was very lively, the intention was to give her the run of the young man. Besides, young men like to feel that there's a young woman not very far away. Polly, of course, flirted with the young man, but Mrs. Mooney, who was a shrewd judge, knew that the young men were only passing time away. None of them meant business. Things went on so for a long time, and Mrs. Mooney began to think of sending Polly back to typewriting, when she noticed that something was going on between Polly and one of the young men. Polly watched the pair and kept her own counsel. Polly knew that she was being watched, but still, her mother's persistent silence could not be misunderstood. There had been no open complicity between mother and daughter, no open understanding, but though people in the house began to talk of the affair, still Mrs. Mooney did not intervene. Polly began to grow a little strange in her manner, and the young man was evidently perturbed. At last, when she judged it to be the right moment, Mrs. Mooney intervened. She dealt with moral problems as a clever deals with meat, and in this case she made up her mind.
It was a bright Sunday morning of early summer, promising heat, but with a fresh breeze blowing. All the windows of the boarding house were open, and the lace curtains ballooned gently towards the street beneath the raised sashes. The belfry of George's Church sent out constant peals, and worshippers, singly or in groups, traversed the little circus before the church, revealing their purpose by their self-contained demeanour, no less than by the little volumes in their gloved hands. Breakfast was over in the boarding house, and the table of the breakfast room was covered with plates on which lay yellow streaks of eggs with morsels of bacon fat and bacon rind. Mrs. Mooney sat in the straw armchair and watched the servant Mary remove the breakfast things. She made Mary collect the crusts and pieces of broken bread to help to make Tuesday's bread pudding. When the table was cleared, the broken bread collected, the sugar and butter safe under lock and key, she began to reconstruct the interview which she had had the night before with Polly. Things were as she had suspected. She had been frank in her questions, and Polly had been frank in her answers. Both had been somewhat awkward, of course. She had been made awkward by her not wishing to receive the news in too cavalier a fashion, or to seem to have connived, and Polly had been made awkward not merely because allusions of that kind always made her awkward, but also because she did not wish it to be thought that in her wise innocence she had divined the intention behind her mother's tolerance. Mrs. Mooney glanced instinctively at the little gilt clock on the mantelpiece as soon as she became aware, through her reverie, that the bells of St. George's Church had stopped ringing. It was 11:17. She would have lots of time to have the matter out with Mr. Dorn and then catch short 12 at Marlborough Street. She was sure she would win. To begin with, she had all the weight of social opinion on her side. She was an outraged mother. She had allowed him to live beneath her roof, assumed that he was a man of honour, and he had simply abused her hospitality. He was 34 or 35 years of age, so that youth could not be pleaded as an excuse, nor could ignorance by his excuse, since he was a man who had seen something of the world. He had simply taken advantage of Polly's youth and inexperience. That was evident. The question was, what reparation would he make? There must be reparations made in such cases. It is all very well for the man. He can go his way as if nothing has happened, having had his moment of pleasure. But the girl had to bear the brunt. Some mothers would be content to patch up such an affair for a sum of money. She had known cases of it. But she would not do so. For her, only one reparation could make up for the loss of her daughter's honour. Marriage. She counted all her cards again before sending Mary up to Mr. Dorn's room to say that she wished to speak with him. She felt sure she would win. He was a serious young man, not rankish or loud-voiced like the others. If it had been Mr. Sheridan or Mr. Mead or Bantam Lyons, her task would have been much harder. She did not think he would face publicity. All the lodgers in the house knew something of the affair. Details had been invented by some. Besides, he had been employed for 13 years in a great Catholic wine merchant's office, and publicity would mean for him perhaps the loss of his job. Whereas, if he agreed, all might be well. She knew he had a good screw for one thing, and she suspected he had a bit of stuff put by. Nearly the half hour, she stood up and surveyed herself in the pier glass. The decisive expression on her great florid face satisfied her, and she thought of some mothers she knew who could not get their daughters off their hands.
Mr. Doran was very anxious indeed this Sunday morning. He made two attempts to shave, but his hand had been so unsteady that he had been obliged to desist. 3 days' reddish beard fringed his jaws, and every 2 or 3 minutes a mist gathered on his glasses, so that he had to take them off and polish them with his pocket hanky. The recollection of his confession of the night before was a cause of acute pain to him. The priest had drawn out every ridiculous detail of the affair, and in the end had so magnified his sins that he was almost thankful at being afforded a loophole of reparation. The harm was done. What could he do now but marry her or run away? He could not brazen it out. The affair would be sure to be the talk of his employer, and his employer would be certain to hear of it. Dublin is such a small city. Everyone knows everyone else's business. He felt his heart leap warmly in his throat as he heard in his excited imagination old Mr. Leonard calling out in his rasping voice, "Send Mr. Doran in here, please." All this long years of service gone for nothing, all his industry and diligence thrown away. As a young man, he had sown his wild oats, of course. He had boasted of his free thinking and denied the existence of God to his companions in the public house. But that was all past and done. Well, nearly. He still bought a copy of Reynolds' newspaper every week, but he attended to his religious duties. And for 9/10 of the year, he lived a regular life. He had money enough to settle down on, but it wasn't that. The family would look down on her. First of all, there was her disreputable father, and then as her mother's boarding house was beginning to get a certain fame, he had a notion he was being had. He could imagine his friends talking of the affair and laughing. She was a little vulgar. Sometimes she had said, "I seen, and if I had a known." But what would grammar matter if he really loved her? He could not make up his mind whether to like her or despise her for what she had done. Of course, he had done it too. His instinct urged him to remain free, not to marry. "Once you are married, you're done for," it said. While he was sitting helplessly on the side of the bed in shirt and trousers, she tapped lightly at the door and entered. She told him all, that she had made a clean breast of it to her mother and that her mother would speak to him in the morning. She cried and threw her arms around his neck, saying, "Oh, Bob, Bob, what am I to do? What am I to do at all?" She would put an end to it herself, she said. He comforted her feebly, telling her not to cry, that it would be all right, never fear. He felt against his shirt the agitation of her bosom. It was not altogether his fault that it had happened. He remembered well, with the curious, patient memory of the celibate, the first casual caresses of her dress, her breath, and that her fingers had given him. Then late one night, as he was undressing for bed, she had tapped on his door timidly. She wanted to relight her candle at his, for hers had been blown out by a gust. It was her bath night. She wore a loose, open, combing jacket of printed flannel. Her white instep shone in the opening of her furry slippers, and the blood glowed warmly beneath her perfumed skin. From her hands and wrists, too, as she lit and steadied the candle, a faint perfume arose. On nights when he had come in very late, it was her who warmed up his dinner. He scarcely knew what he was eating, feeling her beside him, alone, at night, in the sleeping house. And her thoughtfulness. If the night was anyway cold or wet or windy, there was sure to be a little tumbler of punch ready for him. Perhaps they could be happy together. They used to go upstairs together on tiptoe, each with a candle, and on the third landing, exchanged reluctant good nights. They used to kiss. He remembered well her eyes, the touch of her hand, and his delirium. But delirium passes. He echoed her phrase, applying it to himself. "What am I to do?" The instinct of the celibate warned him to hold back. But the sin was there. Even his sense of honour told him that reparation must be made for such a sin. While he was sitting with her on the side of the bed, Mary came to the door and said that the missus wanted to see him down in the parlour. He stood up to put on his coat and waistcoat, more helpless than ever. When he was dressed, he went over to her to comfort her. It would be all right, never fear. He left her crying on the bed and moaning softly. Oh, my God.
Going down the stairs, his glasses became so dimmed with moisture that he had to take them off and polish them. He longed to ascend through the roof and fly away to another country, where he would never hear again of his trouble, and yet a force pushed him downstairs, step by step. The implacable faces of his employer and of the madam stared upon his discomfiture. On the last flight of stairs, he passed Jack Mooney, who was coming up from the pantry nursing two bottles of Bass. They saluted coldly, and the lover's eyes rested for a second or two on a thick bulldog face and a pair of thick, short arms. When he reached the foot of the staircase, he glanced up and saw Jack regarding him from the door of the return room. Suddenly, he remembered the night when one of the music hall artists, a little blonde Londoner, had made a rather free allusion to Polly. The reunion had been almost broken up on account of Jack's violence. Everyone tried to quiet him. The music hall artist, a little paler than usual, kept smiling and saying that there was no harm meant. But Jack kept shouting at him, as if any fellow tried that sort of a game on with his sister, he'd bloody well put his teeth down his throat, so he would. Polly sat for a little time on the side of the bed crying. Then she dried her eyes and went over to the looking glass. She dipped the end of the towel in the water jug and refreshed her eyes with the cool water. She looked at herself in profile and readjusted a hairpin above her ear. Then she went back to the bed again and sat at the foot. She regarded the pillows for a long time, and the sight of them awakened in her mind secret, amiable memories. She rested the nape of her neck against the cool iron bed rail and fell into a reverie. There was no longer any perturbation visible on her face. She waited on patiently, almost cheerfully, without alarm, her memories gradually giving place to hopes and visions of her future. Her hopes and vision were so intricate that she no longer saw the white pillows on which her gaze was fixed or remembered that she was waiting for anything. At last she heard her mother calling. She started to her feet and ran to the banisters. Polly! Polly! Yes, Mama! Come on down there. Mr. Doran wants to speak to you. Then she remembered what she had been waiting for.
You are listening to Reading Together, a New FM initiative co-funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland's Sound Division Fund. Before the break, we listened to one of Joyce's Dubliner short stories, The Boarding House. Next, we will listen to A Mother, read at the Access Arts and Community Resource Centre, Ballymun.
A Mother. Mr. Holohan, Assistant Secretary of the Iri Abu Society, had been walking up and down Dublin for nearly a month with his hands and pockets full of dirty pieces of paper, arranging about a series of concerts. He had a game leg, and for this his friends called him a Hoppy Holohan. He walked up and down constantly, stood by hour at street corners arguing the point and made notes, but in the end it was Mrs. Kearney who arranged everything. Miss Devlin had become Mrs. Kearney out of spite. She had been educated in a high-class convent, where she had learned French and music. And she was naturally pale and unbending in manner, and she made few friends at school. When she came to the age of marriage, she was sent out to many houses where her playing and ivory manners were much admired. She sat amid a chill circle of her accomplishments, waiting for her suitor to brave it and offer her a brilliant life. But the young men whom she met were ordinary, and she gave them no encouragements, trying to console her romantic desires by eating a great deal of Turkish delight in secret. However, she drew near the limit and her friends began to loosen her tongues about her, and she silenced them by marrying Mr. Kearney, who was a bootmaker on Ormond Quay. He was much elder than she. His conversation, which was serious, took place at intervals in the great brown beard. After the first year of married life, Mrs. Kearney perceived that such a man would wear better than a romantic person, but she never put her romantic ideas away. He was sober, thrifty, and pious. He went to the altar every first Friday, sometimes with her, oftener by himself. But she never weakened in her religion, and was a good wife to him. at some party in the strange house, when she lifted her eyebrow often so slightly, he stood up and took his leave, and when his cough troubled him, she put the eider down gilt over his feet and made a strong rum punch. For his part, he was a model father. By paying a small sum every week into society, he ensured for both his daughters a dowry of £100 each when they come to the age of 24. He sent the elder daughter, Kathleen, to a good convent where she learned French and music, and afterward paid her fees at the academy. Every year in the month of July, Mrs. Kearney found occasion to say to some friend, "My good man is packing us off to Skiris for a few weeks." If it was not Skiris, it was Howth or Gaystones. When the Irish revival began to be appreciable, Mrs. Kearney determined to take advantage of her daughter's name and brought an Irish teacher to the house. Kathleen and her sister sent Irish picture postcards to their friends, and these friends sent back other Irish picture postcards. On special Sundays, when Mr. Kearney went with his family to the pro-cathedral, a little crowd of people would assemble after Mass at the corner of Cathedral Street. They were all friends of the Kearneys, musical friends or nationalist friends. And when they had played every little counter of gossip, they shook hands with one another all together, laughing at the crossing of so many hands, and said goodbye to one another in Irish. Soon, name of Miss Kathleen Kearney began to be heard often on people's lips. People said that she was very clever at music and very nice girl, and moreover, that she was a believer in the language movement. Mrs. Kearney was well content at this. Therefore, she was not surprised when one day Mr. Holohan came to her and proposed that her daughter should be accompanist at the series of 4 grand concerts which his society was going to give in the ancient concert rooms. She brought him into the drawing room, made him sit down, and brought out the canter and the silver biscuit barrel. She entered heart and soul into details of the enterprise, advised and dissuaded. And finally, the contract was drawn up, by which Kathleen was to receive 8 guineas for her services and accompanist at the 4 grand concerts. As Mr. Holohan was a novice in such delicate matters as the wording of bills and the disposing of items for program, Mrs. Kearney helped him. She had tact. She knew what artists should go into capitals and what artists should go into small type. She knew that the first tenor would not like to come on after Mr. Mead's comic turn. To keep the audience continually diverted, she slipped the doubtful items in between the old favorites. Mr. Holohan called to see her every day to have her advice on some point. She was invariably friendly and advisingly homely, in fact. She pushed the decanter towards him, saying, "Now, help yourself, Mr. Holohan." And while he was helping himself, she said, "Don't be afraid, don't be afraid of it." Everything went on smoothly. Mrs. Kearney bought some lovely blush-pink charmes in Brown Thomas to let into the front of Kathleen's dress. It cost a pretty penny, but there are occasions when a little expense is justifiable. She took a dozen of 2-shilling tickets for the final concert and sent them to those friends who couldn't be trusted to come otherwise. She forgot nothing, and thanks to her, everything that was to be done was done.
The concerts were to be on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. When Mrs. Kearney arrived with her daughter at the ancient concert rooms on Wednesday night, she did not like the look of things. A few young men, wearing bright blue badges in their coats, stood idly in the vestibule. None of them wore evening dress. She passed by with her daughter, and a quick glance towards the open door of the hall showed her the cause of the steward's idleness. At first, she wondered, had she mistaken the hour? No, it was 8:20. In the dressing room behind the stage, she was introduced to the secretary of the society, Mr. Fitzpatrick. She smiled and shook hands. He was a little man with a white, vacant face. She noticed that he wore his small brown hat carelessly on the side of his head and that his accent was flat. He held a program in his hand, and while he was talking to her, he chewed one end of it into a moist pulp. He seemed to bear disappointments lightly. Mr. Houlihan came into the dressing room every few minutes with reports from the box office. The artists talked among themselves nervously, glancing from time to time at the mirror, and rolled and unrolled their music. When it was nearly 8:30, the few people in the hall began to express their desire to be entertained. Mr. Fitzpatrick came in, smiled vacantly at the room and said, "Well now, ladies and gentlemen, I suppose we better open the ball." Mrs. Kearney rewarded his very flat final syllable with a quick stare of contempt and then said to her daughter encouragingly, "Are you ready, dear?" When she had an opportunity, she called Mr. Houlihan aside and asked him to tell her what it meant. Mr. Houlihan did not know what it meant. He said that the committee had made a mistake in arranging for 4 concerts. 4 was too many. "And the artists?" said Mrs. Kearney. "Of course they are doing their best, but really they are not good." Mr. Houlihan admitted that the artists were not no good, but the committee, he said, had decided to let the first 3 concerts go as they pleased and reserve all the talent for Saturday night. Mrs. Kearney said nothing, but as the mediocre items followed one another on the platform and the few people in the hall grew fewer and fewer, she began to regret that she had put herself to any expense for such a concert. There was something she didn't like in the look of things, and Mr. Fitzpatrick's vacant smile irritated her very much. However, she said nothing and waited to see how it would end. The concert expired shortly before 10, and everyone went home quickly. The concert on Thursday night was better attended, but Mrs. Kearney saw at once that the house was filled with paper. The audience behaved indecorously, as if the concert were an informal dress rehearsal. Mr. Fitzpatrick seemed to enjoy himself. He was quite unconscious that Mrs. Kearney was taking angry note of his conduct. He stood at the edge of the screen, from time to time jutting out his head and exchanging a laugh with 2 friends in the corner of the balcony. In the course of the evening, Mrs. Kearney learned that the Friday concert was to be abandoned and that the committee was going to move heaven and earth to secure a bumper house on Saturday night. When she heard this, she sought out Mr. Houlihan. She buttonholed him as he was limping out quickly with a glass of lemonade for a young lady and asked him, was it true? Yes, it was true. "But, of course, that doesn't alter the contract," she said. "The contract was for 4 concerts." Mr. Houlihan seemed to be in a hurry. He advised her to speak to Mr. Fitzpatrick. Mrs. Kearney was now beginning to be alarmed. She called Mr. Fitzpatrick away from his screen and told him that her daughter had signed for 4 contracts and that, of course, according to the terms of the contract, she should receive the sum originally stipulated for, whether the society gave the 4 concerts or not. Mr. Fitzpatrick, who did not catch the point at issue very quickly, seemed unable to resolve the difficulty and said that he would bring the matter before the committee. Mrs. Kearney's anger began to flutter in her cheek as she had all she could do to keep from asking, "And who is the committee, pray?" But she knew that it would not be ladylike to do that, so she was silent. Little boys were sent out into the principal streets of Dublin early on Friday morning with bundles of handbills. Special puffs appeared in all the evening papers, reminding the music-loving public of the treat that was in store for them on the following evening. Mrs. Kearney was somewhat reassured, but she thought well to tell her husband part of her suspicions. He listened carefully and said that perhaps it would be better if he went with her on Saturday night. She agreed. She respected her husband in the same way as she respected the general post office. As something large, secure and fixed, and though she knew the small number of his talents, she appreciated his abstract value as a male. She was glad that he had suggested coming with her. She thought her plans over.
The night of the grand concert came. Mrs. Kearney with her husband and daughter arrived at the ancient concert rooms 3/4 of an hour before the time of which the concert was to begin. By ill luck, it was a rainy evening. Mrs. Kearney placed her daughter's clothes and music in charge of her husband and went all over the building looking for Mr. Houlihan or Mr. Fitzpatrick. She could find neither. She asked the stewards, was any of the committee in the hall? And after a great deal of trouble, a steward brought out a little woman named Miss Byrne, to whom Miss Kearney explained that she wanted to see one of the secretaries. Miss Byrne expected them any minute and asked, could she do anything? Mrs. Kearney looked searchingly at the oldish face, which was screwed into an expression of trustfulness and enthusiasm, and answered, no, thank you. The little woman hoped they would have a good house. She looked out at the rain until the melancholy of the wet street effaced all the trustfulness and enthusiasm from her twisted features. Then she gave a little sigh and said, ah, well, we did our best, the dear knows. Mrs. Kearney had to go back to the dressing room. The artists were arriving. The bass and the second tenor had already come. The bass, Mr. Duggan, was a slender young man with a scattered black moustache. He was the son of a hall porter in an office in the city, and, as a boy, he had sung prolonged bass notes in the resounding hall. From this humble state, he had raised himself until he had become a first-rate artiste. He had appeared in grand opera, and one night, when an operatic artist had fallen ill, he had undertaken the part of the king in the opera of Maritana at the Queen's Theatre. He sang his music with great feeling and volume and was warmly welcomed by the gallery. But, unfortunately, he marred the good impression by wiping his nose and his gloved hands once or twice out of thoughtfulness. He was unassuming and spoke a little. He said, "Yous," so softly that it passed unnoticed, and he never drank anything stronger than milk for his voice's sake. Mr. Bell, the second tenor, was a fair-haired little man who competed every year for prizes at the Festspiele. On his fourth trial, he had been awarded a bronze medal. He was extremely nervous and extremely jealous of other tenors, and he covered his nervous jealousy with an ebullient friendliness. It was his humour to have people know what an ordeal a concert was for him. Therefore, when he saw Mr. Duggan, he went over to him and asked, "Are you in it too?" "Yes," said Mr. Duggan. Mr. Bell laughed at his fellow sufferer and held out his hand. "Shake." Mrs. Kearney passed by those two young men and went to the edge of the screen to view the house. The seats were being filled up rapidly, and a pleasant noise circulated in the auditorium. She came back and spoke to her husband privately. Their conversation was evidently about Kathleen, for they both glanced at her often as she stood chatting to one of her nationalist friends, Miss Healy, the contralto. An unknown solitary woman with a pale face walked through the room. The women followed her with keen eyes, the faded blue dress which stretched upon her meagre body. Someone said she was Madame Glynn, the soprano. "Where did they dig her up?" said Kathleen to Miss Healy. "I'm sure I never heard of her." Miss Healy had to smile. Mr. Houlihan limped into the dressing room at that moment, and the two young ladies asked him who was the unknown woman. Mr. Houlihan said that she was Madame Glynn from London. Madame Glynn took her stand in the corner of the room, holding a roll of music stiffly before her, and from time to time changing the direction of her startled gaze. The shadow took her faded dress into shelter, but fell revengefully on the little cup behind her collarbone. The noise of the hall became more audible. The first tenor and the baritone arrived together. They were both well-dressed, stout and complacent, and they brought a breath of opulence among the company. Mrs. Kearney brought her daughter over to them and talked to them amiably. She wanted to be on good terms with them, but while she strove to be polite, her eyes followed Mr. Houlihan in his limping and devious courses. As soon as she could, she excused herself and went over to him. "Mr. Houlihan, I want to speak to you," she said. They went down to a discreet part of the corridor. Mrs. Kearney asked him what her daughter was going to be paid. Mr. Houlihan said that Mr. Fitzpatrick had charge of that. Mrs. Kearney said she didn't know anything about Mr. Fitzpatrick. Her daughter had signed a contract for 8 guineas and she would have to be paid. Mr. Houlihan said wasn't his business. "Why isn't it your business?" asked Mrs. Kearney. "Didn't you yourself bring her the contract? Anyway, if it's not your business, it's my business, and I mean to see to it." "You'd better speak to Mr. Fitzpatrick," said Mr. Houlihan distantly. "I don't know about Mr. Fitzpatrick. I have my contract, and I intend to see it carried out." When she came back to the dressing room, her cheeks were slightly suffused. The room was lively. Two men in outdoor dress had taken possession of the fireplace and were chatting familiarly with Miss Healy and the baritone. They were the Freeman Man and Mr. O'Madden Burke. The Freeman Man had come in to say that he could not wait for the concert as he had to report the lecture which an American priest was given in the Mansion House. He said they were to leave the report for him at the Freeman office and then he would see it in. He was a grey-haired man with a plausible voice and careful manners. He held an extinguished cigar in his hand and the aroma of cigar smoke floated around him. He had not intended to stay a minute because concerts and artists bored him considerably, but he remained leaning against the mantelpiece. Miss Healy stood in front of him, talking and laughing. He was old enough to suspect one reason for her politeness, but young enough in spirit to turn the moment to account. The fragrance, warmth and colour of her body appealed to his senses. He was pleasantly conscious that the bosom which he saw rise and fall beneath him rose and fell at that moment for him, and that the laughter and fragrance and willful glances were also his tribute. When he could stay no longer, he took leave of her regretfully. Mr. O'Madden will write the notice, he explained to Mr. Houlihan, and I'll see it in. Thank you very much, Mr. Hendricks, said Mr. Houlihan. You'll see it in, I know. Now, won't you have a little something before you go? Oh, I don't mind, said Mr. Hendrick.
The two men went along some tortuous passages and up a dark staircase and came to a secluded room where one of the stewards was uncorking bottles for a few gentlemen. One of these gentlemen was Mr. O'Madden Burke, who had found out the room by instinct. He was a suave, elderly man who balanced his imposing body, when at rest, upon a large silk umbrella. His magniloquent Western name was the moral umbrella upon which he balanced the fine problem of his finances. He was widely respected. While Mr. Houlihan was entertaining the freeman, Mrs. Kearney was speaking so animatedly to her husband that he had to ask her to lower her voice. The conversation of the others in the dressing room had become strained. Mr. Bell, the first item, stood ready with his music, but the accompanist made no sign. Evidently, something was wrong. Mr. Kearney looked straight before him, stroking his beard, while Mrs. Kearney spoke into Kathleen's ear with subdued emphasis. From the hall came sounds of encouragement, clapping and stamping of feet. The first tenor and the baritone and Miss Healy stood together, waiting tranquilly. But Mr. Bell's nerves were getting agitated because he was afraid the audience would think that he had come late. Mr. Houlihan and Mr. O'Madden Burke came into the room. In a moment, Mr. Houlihan perceived the hush. He went over to Mrs. Kearney and spoke with her earnestly. While they were speaking, the noise in the hall grew louder. Mr. Houlihan became very red and excited. He spoke volubly, but Mrs. Kearney said curtly at intervals, "She won't go on. She must get her 8 guineas. Mr. Houlihan pointed desperately towards the hall, where the audience was clapping and stamping. He appealed to Mr. Kearney and Kathleen, but Mr. Kearney continued to stroke his beard, and Kathleen looked down, moving the point of her new shoe. It was not her fault. Mrs. Kearney repeated, "She won't go on without her money." After a swift struggle of tones, Mr. Houlihan hobbled out in haste. The room was silent. When the strain of the silence had become somewhat painful, Miss Healy said to the baritone, "Have you seen Mrs. Pat Campbell this week?" The baritone had not seen her, but he had been told that she was very fine. The conversation went no further. The first tenor bent his head and began to count the links of the gold chain which was extended across his waist, smiling and humming random notes to observe the effect of the frontal sinus. From time to time, everyone glanced at Mrs. Kearney. The noise in the auditorium had risen to a clamour when Mr. Fitzpatrick burst into the room, followed by Mr. Houlihan, who was panting. The clapping and stamping in the hall were punctuated by whistling. Mr. Fitzpatrick held a few banknotes in his hand. He counted out 4 into Mrs. Kearney's hand and said she would get the other half at the interval. Mrs. Kearney said, "This is 4 shillings short." But Kathleen gathered in her skirt and said, "Now, Mr. Bell," to the first item, who was shaking like an aspen. The singer and the accompanist went out together. The noise in the hall died away. There was a pause of a few seconds, and then the piano was heard. The first part of the concert was very successful, except for Madame Glynn's item. The poor lady said "Killarney" in a bodiless, gasping voice, with all the old-fashioned mannerisms of intonation and pronunciation which she believed lent elegance to her singing. She looked as if she had been resurrected from an old stage wardrobe, and the cheaper parts of the hall made fun of her high, wailing notes. The first tenor and the contralto, however, brought down the house. Kathleen played a selection of Irish airs, which was generously applauded. The first part closed with a stirring, patriotic recitation delivered by a young lady who arranged amateur theatricals. It was deservedly applauded. And, when it was ended, the men went out for the interval, content. All this time in the dressing room was a hive of excitement. In one corner were Mr. Houlihan, Mr. Fitzpatrick, Miss Byrne, two of the stewards, the baritone, the bass, and Mr. Madden Burke. Mr. Madden Burke said it was the most scandalous exhibition he had ever witnessed. Miss Kathleen Kearney's musical career was ended in Dublin after that, he said. The baritone was asked what did he think of Mrs. Kearney's conduct. He did not like to say anything. He had been paid his money and wished to be at peace with men. However, he said that Mrs. Kearney might have taken the artists into consideration. The stewards and the secretaries debated hotly as to what should be done when the interval came. I agree with Miss Byrne, said Mr. Madden Burke. Pay her nothing. In another corner of the room, where Mrs. Kearney and her husband, Mr. Bell, Miss Healy, and the young lady who had to recite the patriotic piece, Mrs. Kearney said that the committee had treated her scandalously. She had spared neither trouble nor expense, and this was how she was repaid. They thought they had only a girl to deal with, and that, therefore, they could ride roughshod over her. But she would show them their mistake. They wouldn't have dared to have treated her like that if she had been a man. But she would see that her daughter got her rights. She wouldn't be fooled. If they didn't pay her to the last farthing, she would make Dublin ring. Of course she was sorry for the sake of the artists, but what else could she do? She appealed to the second tenor, who said he thought that she had not been well treated. Then she appealed to Miss Healy. Miss Healy wanted to join the other group, but she did not like to do so because she was a great friend of Kathleen's, and the Kearneys had often invited her to their house.
As soon as the first part was ended, Mr. Fitzpatrick and Mr. Houlihan went over to Mrs. Kearney and told her that the other 4 guineas would be paid after the committee meeting on the following Tuesday, and that in case her daughter did not play for the second part, the committee would consider the contract broken and would pay nothing. I haven't seen any committee, said Mrs. Kearney angrily. My daughter has her contract. She will get her £4 into her hand or a foot she won't put on that platform. I'm surprised at you, Mrs. Kearney, said Mr. Houlihan. I never thought you would treat us this way. And what way did you treat me? Asked Mrs. Kearney. Her face was inundated with an angry colour, and she looked as if she would attack someone with her hands. I'm asking for my rights. Well, you might have some sense of decency, said Mr. Houlihan. Might I indeed? And when I ask when my daughter is going to get paid, I can't get a civil answer. She tossed her head and assumed a haughty voice. You must speak to the secretary. Oh, it's not my business. I'm a great fellow for all the diddle I do. I thought you were a lady, said Mr. Houlihan, walking away from her abruptly. After that, Mrs. Kearney's conduct was condemned on all hands. Haggard and with rage, she argued with her husband and daughter, gesticulating with them. She waited until it was time for the second part to begin, in the hope that the secretaries would approach her. But Miss Healy had kindly consented to play one or two accompaniments, and Mrs. Kearney had to stand aside to allow the baritone and his accompanist to pass up to the platform. She stood still for an instant, like an angry stone image, and when the first note of the song struck her ear, she caught up her daughter's cloak and said to her husband, "Get a cab!" He went out at once. Mrs. Kearney wrapped the cloak around her daughter and followed him. As she passed through the doorway, she stopped and glared into Mr. Houlihan's face. I'm not done with you yet, she said. But I'm done with you, said Mr. Houlihan. Kathleen followed her daughter meekly. Mr. Houlihan began to pace up and down the room in order to cool himself, for his skin was on fire. Oh, that's a nice lady, he said. Oh, that's a nice lady. You did the proper thing, Houlihan, said Mr. O'Madden Burke, poised upon his umbrella in approval.
I met with Napper Candy, and he took me by the hand, and he said how poor old Ireland, and how does she stand? She's the most distressful country that ever yet was seen, for they're hanging men and women there for wearing of the green.
That was all for today's Reading Together programme. But before we go, we want to thank our readers, Geraldine Mead, Anna Martin, Kasia Sudak, and all at the Access Arts and Community Resource Centre, Ballymun, for their help and support.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.